Part 6. Citizens. I am a kind of farthing dip, unfriendly to the nose and eyes, a blue behinded ape I skip upon the trees of paradise. Robert Louis Stevenson. A Portrait. Chapter 92. Galactics.
They exist. They have substance. They are.
The assembled Gubru officials and officers bobbed their downy heads and cried out in unison, Zoon!
This prize was denied us. Honor was set aside. Opportunity abandoned. All in the name of penny-pinching, miserly bean-counting. Now the cost will be greater, multiplied, exponentiated.
The suzerain of cost and caution stood miserably in the corner, listening amid a small crowd of loyal assistants, while it was berated from all sides. It shivered each time the conclave turned and shouted its refrain. The suzerain of propriety stood tall upon its perch. It stepped back and forth, fluffing up, to best display the new color that had begun to show under its molting plumage. The assembled Gubru and Quacku reacted to that shade with chirps of passionate devotion.
And now a derelict, recalcitrant, stubborn one, forestalls our molt and consensus, out of which we might at least regain something. Gain honor and allies. Gain peace.
The suzerain spoke of their missing colleague, the military commander, who dared not, it seemed, come and face propriety's new color, its new supremacy. A four-legged Quacku hurriedly approached, bowed, and delivered a message to its leader's perch. Almost as an afterthought, a copy made its way to the suzerain of cost and caution as well. The news from the Poorman transfer point was not surprising. Echoes had been heard of great starships bearing down upon Garth in mighty numbers. After that debacle of an uplift ceremony, the new arrivals were only to be expected.
Well?
The suzerain of propriety queried the several military officers who were present.
Does Beam and Talon plan a defense of this world against all advice, all wisdom, and all honor?
The officers, of course, did not know. They had deserted their warrior leader as the confusing, unhappy, molt coalescence suddenly reversed direction. The suzerain of propriety danced a dance of impatience.
You do me no good. Do the clan no good. Standing about in righteousness. Go back. Seek out. Return to your posts. Do your duties as he commands. But keep me informed of what he plans and does.
Use of the male pronoun was deliberate. Though molt was not yet complete, anyone could tell without dropping feathers which way the wind was blowing. The officers bowed and rushed as one out of the pavilion. Chapter 93. Robert. Debris littered the now quiescent ceremonial mound. Stiff easterly winds riffled the lawn-like slopes, tugging at stringy rubbish blown in earlier from the distant mountains. Here and there city chims poked through trash on the lower terraces, looking for souvenirs. Higher up, only a few pavilions still stood. Around these, several dozen large black forms lazily groomed each other's fur and gossiped with their hands, as if they had never had anything more momentous on their minds than who would mate with whom, and what they would be fed next meal. To Robert it seemed as if the gorillas were quite well satisfied with life. I envy them, he thought. In his case, even a great victory did not bring an end to worry. Things were still quite dangerous on Garth. Perhaps even more so than two nights ago, when fate and coincidence intervened to surprise them all. Life was troubling sometimes. All the time. Robert returned his attention to his data well, and the letter the Uplift Institute officials had relayed to him only an hour before.
"Of course, it's very hard for an old woman, especially one who, like me, has grown so used to having her own way. But I know I must acknowledge how mistaken I was about my own son. I have wronged you, and for that I am sorry. In my own defense, I can only say that outward appearances can be misleading. And you were outwardly such an aggravating boy. I suppose I should have had the sense to see underneath to the strength you have shown during these months of crisis, but that just never occurred to me. Perhaps I was afraid of examining my own feelings too closely. In any event, we'll have much time to talk about this after peace comes. Let's let it go now by saying that I am very proud of you. Your country and your clan owe you much, as does your grateful mother. With affection, Megan."
How odd, Robert thought, that after so many years despairing of ever winning her approval, now he had it, and didn't know how to deal with it. Ironically, he felt sympathy for his mother. It was obviously so very difficult for her to say these things at all. He made allowances for the cool tone of the words themselves. All Garth saw Megan Aneagle as a gracious lady and fair administrator. Only her wandering husbands and Robert himself knew the other side, the one so utterly terrified by permanent obligation and issues of private loyalty. This was the first time in all his life that Robert recalled her apologizing for something really important, something involving family and intense emotions. Blurring of vision made him close his eyes. Robert blamed the symptoms on the fringing fields of a lifting starship, whose keening engines could be heard all the way from the spaceport. He wiped his cheeks and watched the great liner, silvery and almost angelic in its serene beauty, rise and pass overhead on its leisurely way out to space and beyond.
"One more batch of fleeing rats," he murmured.
Uther Calving did not bother turning to look. He lay back on his elbows, watching the gray waters.
"The galactic visitors have already had more entertainment than they bargained for, Robert. That uplift ceremony was plenty. To most of them, the prospect of a space battle and siege are much less enticing."
"One of each has been quite enough for me," Vivian Bulger added without opening his eyes.
He lay a little down slope, his head on Galet Jones's lap. For the moment, she also had little to say, but concentrated on removing a few tangles from his fur, careful of his still livid black and blue bruises. Meanwhile, Jojo groomed one of Fibbin's legs.
"Well, he's earned it," Robert thought.
Although the uplift ceremony had been preempted by the guerrillas, the test scores handed down by the Institute still held. If humanity managed to get out of its present troubles and could afford the expense of a new ceremony, two rustic colonials from Garth would lead the next procession, ahead of all the sophisticated chims of Terra. Though Fibbin himself seemed uninterested in the honor, Robert was proud of his friend. A female chim wearing a simple frock approached up the trail. She bowed languidly in a brief nod to Uther Calving and Robert.
"Who wants the latest news?"
Michaela Noddings asked.
"Not me," Fibbin grumped.
"Tell the universe to go Fibbin?"
Galet chided gently. She looked up at Michaela.
"I want to hear it."
The chimmies sat and began working on Fibbin's other shoulder. Mollified, he closed his eyes again.
"Kalt has heard from his people," Michaela said. "The Thenanen are on their way here. Already, Robert whistled. They aren't wasting any time, are they?
Michaela shook her head. Kalt's folk have already contacted the Terrigan's Council to negotiate purchase of the fallow gorilla genetic base and to hire Earth experts as consultants.
I hope the Council holds out for a good prize.
Beggars can't be choosers, Galet suggested. According to some of the departing galactic observers, Earth is in pretty desperate straits, as are the Timbremi. If this deal means we lose the Thenanin as enemies, and maybe win them as allies instead, it could be vital.
At the price of losing gorillas, our cousins, as clients of our own, Robert mulled.
On the night of the ceremony, he had only seen the hilarious irony of it all, sharing that Timbremi way of viewing things with Uther Calding. Now, though, it was harder not to count the cost in serious terms.
They were never really ours in the first place, he reminded himself. At least, we'll have a say in how they're raised, and Uther Calding says some Thenanin aren't as bad as many.
What about the Gubru? He asked. They agreed to make peace with Earth in exchange for acceptance of the ceremony.
Well, it wasn't exactly the sort of ceremony they had in mind, was it?
Galet answered.
What do you think, Ambassador Uther Calding?
The Timbrimi's tendrils waved lazily. All of yesterday and this morning, he had been crafting little glyphs of puzzle-like intricacy, far beyond Robert's limited ability to ken, as if he were delighting in the rediscovery of something he had lost.
They will act in what they see to be their own self-interest, of course,
Uther Calding said.
The question is whether they will have the sense to know what is good for them.
What do you mean?
I mean that the Gubru apparently began this expedition with confused goals. Their triumvirate reflected conflicting factions back home. The initial intent of their expedition here was to use the hostage population of Garth to pry secrets out of the Terrigan's Council. But then they learned that Earth is as ignorant as everybody else about what that infamous dolphin ship of yours discovered.
Has there been any new word about the Streaker? Robert interrupted. Spiraling off a Palang glyph, Uther Calding sighed.
The dolphins seem to have miraculously escaped a trap set for them by a dozen of the most fanatic patron lines, an astonishing feat by itself. And now the Streaker seems to be loose on the star lanes. The humiliated fanatics lost tremendous face, and so tensions have reached an even higher level than before. It is one more reason why the Gubru roostmasters grow increasingly frightened.
So, when the invaders found they couldn't use hostages to coerce secrets out of Earth, the suzerains searched for other ways to make some profit out of this expensive expedition,
Galet surmised.
Correct. But when the first suzerain of Cost and Caution was killed, it threw their leadership process out of balance. Instead of negotiating toward a consensus of policy, the three suzerains engaged in unbridled competition for the top position in their molt. I'm not sure that even now I understand all of the schemes that might have been involved, but the final one, the one they settled on at last, will cost them very dearly. Blatantly interfering with the proper outcome of an uplift ceremony is a grave matter.
Robert saw Galet wince in revulsion, as she obviously recollected how she had been used. Without opening his eyes, Fibbon reached out and took her hand.
Where does that leave us now?
Robert asked Uther Calding.
Both common sense and honor would demand the Gubru keep their bargain with Earth. It's the only way out of a terrible bind.
But you don't expect them to see it that way.
Would I remain confined here on neutral ground if I did? You and I, Robert, would be with Athaclena right now, dining on kugra and other delicacies I'd cached away, and we would speak for hours of, oh, so many things. But that will not happen until the Gubru decide between logic and self-immolation.
Robert felt a chill. How bad could it get? He asked in a low voice. The Chims, too, listened quietly. Uthakalding looked around. He inhaled the sweet, chill air, as if it were of fine vintage.
This is a lovely world, he sighed. And yet it has suffered horror. Sometimes so-called civilization seems bent on destroying those very things which it has sworn to protect.
Chapter 94 Galactics.
After them,
cried the suzerain of Beam and Talon.
Chase them! Pursue them!
Talon soldiers and their battle drones swooped down upon a small column of neo-chimpanzees, taking them by surprise. The hairy earthlings turned to fight, firing their ill-assorted weapons upward at the stooping Gubru. Two small fireballs did erupt, emitting sprays of singed feathers, but for the most part resistance was useless. Soon the suzerain was stepping delicately among the blasted remains of trees and mammals. It cursed, as its officers reported, only Chim bodies. There had been stories of others, humans and Timbrimi, and yes, thrice cursed Thenanin. Had not one of them suddenly appeared out of the wilderness? They had to all be in league together. It had to be a plot. Now there were constant messages, entreaties, demands that the Admiral return to Port Helenia, that it join with the other commanders for a conclave, a meeting, a new struggle for consensus. Consensus. The suzerain of Beam and Talon spat on the trunk of a shattered tree. Already you could feel the ebbing of hormones, the leaching away of color that had almost been its own. Consensus? The Admiral would show them consensus. It was determined to win back its position of leadership, and the only way to do that, after the catastrophe of an uplift ceremony, was to demonstrate the efficacy of the military option. When the Thenanin came to claim their Garthling prizes, they would be met with force. Let them engage in uplift of their new clients from deep space. Of course, to keep them at bay, in order to return this world for the Roost Masters, there must be complete surety that there would be no attacks from behind, from the surface. The ground opposition had to be eliminated. The suzerain of Beam and Talon refused even to consider the possibility that anger and revenge might also have colored its decisions. To have admitted that would be to begin to fall under the sway of propriety. Already several good officers had deserted down that path, only to be ordered back to their posts by the sanctimonious high priest. That was particularly galling. The Admiral was determined to win their loyalty back in its own right with victory.
The new detectors work, are effective, are efficient.
It danced in satisfaction.
They let us hunt the Earthlings without needing to scent special materials. We trace them by their very blood.
The suzerain's assistants shared its satisfaction. At this rate, the Irregulars should soon all be dead. A pall fell over the celebration when it was reported that one of the troop carriers that had brought them here had broken down. Another casualty of the plague of corrosion that had struck Gubru equipment all over the mountains and the Vale of Sindh. The suzerain had ordered an urgent investigation.
No matter. We shall all ride the remaining carriers. Nothing, nobody, no event shall stop our hunt.
The soldiers chanted,
Zoon!
Chapter 95 Athaclena. She watched as the hirsute human read the message for the fourth time, and could not help wondering whether she was doing the right thing. Rank-haired, bearded, and naked, Major Prathachilthorn looked the very essence of a wild, carnivorous wolfling, a creature far too dangerous to trust. He looked down at the message, and for a moment all she could read were the waves of tension that coursed up his shoulders and down his arms to those powerful, tightly flexed hands.
"It appears that I am under orders to forgive you and to follow your policies, Miss."
The last word ended in a hiss.
"Does this mean that I'll be set free if I promise to be good? How can I be sure this order is for real?"
Athaklana knew she had little choice. In the days ahead, she would not be able to spare the Chim power to continue guarding Prathachilthorn. Those she could rely upon to ignore the human's command voice were very few, and he had already nearly escaped on four separate occasions. The alternative was to finish him off here and now, and for that, she simply had not the will.
"I have no doubt you would kill me the instant you discovered the message wasn't genuine,"
Athaklana replied. His teeth seemed to flash.
"You have my word on that," he assured her. "And on what else?"
He closed and then reopened his eyes.
"According to these orders from the government in exile, I have no choice but to act as if I was never kidnapped, to pretend there was no mutiny, and to conform my strategy to your advice." "All right. I agree to this. As long as you remember that I'm going to appeal to my commanders on Earth, first chance I get, and they will take this to the TAASF, and once Coordinator on Eagle is overruled, I will find you, my young Tim Brimmy. I will come to you."
The bald, open hatred in his mind simultaneously made her shiver, and also reassured her. The man held nothing back. Truth burned beneath his words. She nodded to Benjamin.
"Let him go."
Looking unhappy and avoiding eye contact with the dark-haired human, the Chims lowered the cage and cut open the door. Prathachilthorn emerged, rubbing his arms. Then quite suddenly he whirled and leaped in a high kick, landing in a stance one blow away from her. He laughed as Athaklana and the Chims backed away.
"Where is my command?" he asked tersely.
"I do not know precisely,"
Athaklana answered, as she tried to abort a gear flux.
"We've scattered into small parties, and even had to abandon the caves when it was clear they were compromised."
"And what about this place?"
Prathachilthorn motioned to the steaming slopes of Mount Fosse.
"We expect the enemy to stage an assault here at any moment,"
she replied honestly.
"Well," he said, "I didn't believe half of what you told me yesterday about that uplift ceremony and its consequences, but I'll give you this. You and your dad do seem to have stirred up the Gubru good."
He sniffed the air as if already he were trying to pick up a spore.
"I assume you have a tactical situation map and a data well for me?"
Benjamin brought one of the portable computer units forward, but Prathachilthorn held up a hand.
"Not now. First, let's get out of here. I want to get away from this place."
Athaklana nodded. She could well understand how the man felt. He laughed when she declined his mock chivalrous bow and insisted that he go first.
"As you wish," he chuckled.
Soon they were swinging through the trees and running under the thick forest canopy. Not much later, they heard what sounded like thunder back where the refuge had been, even though there were no clouds in the sky. Chapter 96. Sylvie. The night was lit by fiery beacons which burst forth actinically and cast stark shadows as they drifted slowly groundward. Their impact on the senses was sudden, dazzling, overwhelming even the noise of battle and the screams of the dying. It was the defenders who sent the blazing torches into the sky, for their assailants needed no light to guide them. Streaking in by radar and infrared, they attacked with deadly accuracy, until momentarily blinded by the brilliance of the flares. Chims fled the evening's fireless camp in all directions, naked, carrying only food and a few weapons on their backs. Mostly they were refugees from mountain hamlets burned down in the recent surge of fighting. A few trained irregulars remained behind in a desperate rear guard action to cover the civilians' retreat. They used what means they had to confuse the airborne enemy's deadly precise detectors. The flares were sophisticated, automatically adjusting their fulminations to best interfere with active and passive sensors. They slowed the avians down, but only for a little while, and they were in short supply. Besides, the enemy had something new, some secret system, that was letting them track Chims even under the heaviest growth, even naked, without the simplest trappings of civilization. All the pursued could do was split up into smaller and smaller groups. The prospect facing those who made it away from here was to live completely as animals, alone, or, at most in pairs, wild-eyed and cowering under skies that had once been theirs to roam at will. Sylvie was helping an older Chimmy and two children climb over a vine-covered tree trunk, when suddenly upraised hackles told her of gravitics drawing near. She quickly signed for the others to take cover, but something, perhaps it was the unsteady rhythm of those motors, made her stay behind, peering over the rim of a fallen log. In the blackness she barely caught the flash of a dim, whitish shape plummeting through the starlit forest to crash noisily among the branches and then disappear into the jungle gloom. Sylvie stared down the dark channel the plunging vessel had cut. She listened, chewing on her fingernails, as debris rained down in its wake.
"Donna,"
she whispered. The elderly Chimmy lifted her head from under a pile of leaves.
"Can you make it with the children the rest of the way to the rendezvous?"
Sylvie asked.
"All you have to do is head downhill to a stream, then follow that stream to a small waterfall and cave. Can you do that?"
Donna paused for a long moment, concentrating, and at last nodded.
"Good,"
Sylvie said.
"When you see Petri, tell him I saw an enemy scout come down, and I'm going to go and look it over."
Fear had widened the older Chimmy's eyes, so that the whites shone around her irises. She blinked a couple of times, then held out her arms for the children. By the time they were gathered under her protection, Sylvie had already cautiously entered the tunnel of broken trees.
"Why am I doing this?"
Sylvie wondered, as she stepped over broken branches, still oozing pungent sap. Tiny skittering motions told of native creatures seeking cover after the ruination of their homes. The smell of ozone put Sylvie's hair on end. And then, as she drew nearer, there came another familiar odor, one of overripe bird. Everything looked eerie in the dimness. There were absolutely no colors, only shades of Stygian gray. When the off-white bulk of the crashed aircraft loomed in front of her, Sylvie saw that it lay canted at a 40-degree slope, its front end quite crumpled from the impact. She heard a faint crackling as some piece of electronics shorted again and again. Other than that, there came no sound from within. The main hatch had been torn half off its hinges. Touching the still warm hull for guidance, she approached cautiously. Her fingers traced the outlines of one of the gravitic impellers, and flakes of corrosion came off.
"Lousy maintenance,"
she thought, partly in order to keep her mind busy.
I wonder if that's why it crashed.
Her mouth was dry and her heart felt in her throat as she reached the opening and bent to peer around the corner. Two Gubru still lay strapped at their stations, their sharp-beaked heads lolling from slender, broken necks. Sylvie tried to swallow. She made herself lift one foot and step gingerly onto the sloping deck. Her pulse threatened to stop when the plates groaned and one of the Talon soldiers moved. But it was only the broken vessel, creaking and settling slightly.
"Good all,"
Sylvie moaned as she brought her hand down from her breast. It was hard to concentrate with all of her instincts screaming just to get the hell out of here. As she had for many days, Sylvie tried to imagine what Galet Jones would do under circumstances like this. She knew she would never be the Chimmy Galet was. That just wasn't in the cards. But if she tried hard...
"Weapons,"
she whispered to herself, and forced her trembling hands to pull the soldiers' sidearms from their holsters. Seconds seemed like hours, but soon two racked saber rifles joined the pistols in a pile outside the hatch. Sylvie was about to lower herself to the ground when she hissed and slapped her forehead.
"Idiot! Ethaclena needs intelligence more than popguns."
She returned to the cockpit and peered about, wondering if she would recognize something significant, even if it lay right in front of her.
"Come on! You're a Terrigan citizen, with most of a college education, and you spent months working for the Gubru."
Concentrating, she recognized the flight controls and, from symbols obviously pertaining to missiles, the weapons console. Another display, still lit by the craft's draining batteries, showed a relief territory map, with multiple sigils and designations written in Galactic 3.
"Could this be what they are using to find us?" she wondered.
A dial just below the display used words she knew in the enemy's language. "Band selector," the label said. Experimentally, she touched it. A window opened in the lower left corner of the display. More arcane writing spilled forth, much too complex for her. But above the text, there now whirled a complex design that an adult of any civilized society would recognize as a chemical diagram. Sylvie was no chemist, but she had had a basic education, and something about the molecule depicted there looked oddly familiar to her. She concentrated and tried to sound out the identifier, the word, just below the diagram. The Gal 3 syllabary came back to her.
"Ki-him-himug."
Sylvie felt her skin suddenly coarse with goosebumps. She traced the line of her lips with her tongue and then whispered a single word.
"Hemoglobin."
Chapter 97 Galactics.
Biological warfare.
The suzerain of Beam and Talon hopped about the bridge of the cruising battleship on which it held court and pointed at the Kwaku technician who had brought the news.
"This corrosion, this decay, this blight on armor and machinery, it was created by design?"
The technician bowed.
"Yes, there are several agents, bacteria, prions, molds. When we saw the pattern, countermeasures were instituted at once. It will take time to treat all affected surfaces with organisms engineered against theirs, but success will eventually reduce this to a mere nuisance."
Eventually, the Admiral thought bitterly.
"How were these agents delivered?"
The Kwaku pulled from its pouch a filmy clump of cloth-like material bound by slender strands.
"When these things began blowing in from the mountains, we consulted library records and questioned the locals. Irritating infestations occur regularly on this continental coast with the onset of winter, so we ignored them. However, it now appears the mountain insurgents have found a way to infect these airborne spore carriers with biological entities destructive to our equipment. By the time we were aware, the dispersal was nearly universal. The plot was most ingenious.
The military commander paced.
How bad, how severe, how catastrophic is the damage?
Again, a deep bow.
One-third of our planet-side transport is affected. Two of the spaceport defense batteries will be out of commission for 10 planetary days. 10 days! As you know, we are no longer receiving spares from the homeworld.
The Admiral did not need to be reminded. Already most roads to Gimelhai had been interdicted by the approaching alien armadas, now patiently clearing mines away from the fringes of Garth's system. And if that weren't enough, the two other suzerains were now united in opposing the military. There was nothing they could do to prevent the coming battles if the Admiral's party chose to fight, but they could withhold both religious and bureaucratic support. The effects of that were already showing. The pressures had built until a steady, throbbing pain seemed to pulse within the Admiral's head.
They will pay!
The suzerain shrieked. Curse the limitations of priests and egg counters! The suzerain of Beam and Talon recalled with fond longing the grand fleets it had led into this system. But long ago, most of those ships had been pulled away by the Roostmasters to meet other desperate needs, and probably quite a few of them were already smoking ruins or vapor out on the contentious galactic marches. In order to avoid such thoughts, the Admiral contemplated instead the noose now tightening around the shrinking mountain strongholds of the insurgents. Soon that worry, at least, would be over forever. And then... well, let the Uplift Institute enforce the neutrality of its sacred ceremonial mound in the midst of a pitched planet-space battle. Under such circumstances, missiles were known to fall astray, such as into civilian towns, or even neutral ground. Too bad. There would be commiseration, of course. Such a pity. But those were the fortunes of war. Chapter 98 Utha Calding. No longer did he have to hold secret the yearnings in his heart, or keep contained his deep, stored reservoir of feelings. It did not matter if alien detectors pinpointed his psychic emanations, for they surely would know where to find him. When the time came... At dawn, while the east grew gray with the cloud-shrouded sun, Utha Calding walked along the dew-covered slopes and reached out with everything he had. The miracle of some days back had burst the chrysalis of his soul. Where he thought only winter would forever reign, now bright shoots burst forth. To both humans and Timbrimi, love was considered the greatest power. But there was indeed something to be said for irony as well.
I live and ken the world as beautiful.
He poured all of his craft into a glyph which floated, delicate and light, above his wafting tendrils. To be brought to this place, so near where his schemes began, and to witness how all his jests had been turned around upon himself, giving him all he had wanted, but in such amazing ways. Dawn brought color to the world. It was a winter land and seascape of barren orchards and tarp-covered ships. The waters of the bay wore lines of wind-flecked foam, and yet the sun gave warmth. He thought of the universe, so strange, often bizarre, and so filled with danger and tragedy. But also surprise.
Surprise. The blessing that tells one that this is real.
He spread his arms to encompass it all.
That even the most imaginative of us, could not have made all this up within his own mind.
He did not set the glyph free. It cast loose as if of its own accord, and rose unaffected by the morning winds, to drift wherever chance might take it. Later came long consultations with the Grand Examiner, with Colt, and Cordwainer Appleby. They all sought his advice. He tried not to disappoint them. Around noon, Robert Oneagle drew him aside and brought up again the idea of escape. The young human wanted to break out of their confinement on the ceremonial mound and head off with Thibin to cause the Gubru grief. They all knew of the fighting in the mountains, and Robert wanted to help Athaclena in any way possible. Uther Calding sympathized.
"But you underestimate yourself in thinking you could ever do this, my son," he told the young man.
Robert blinked.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that the Gubru military are now well aware of how dangerous you and Thibin are, and perhaps through some small efforts of my own, they include me on their list. Why do you think they maintain such patrols, when they must have other pressing needs?"
He motioned at the craft, which cruised just beyond the perimeter of Institute territory. No doubt even the coolant lines leading to the power stations were watched by expensive drones of deadly sophistication. Robert had suggested using homemade gliders, but the enemy was surely wise even to that wolfling trick by now. They had had expensive lessons.
"In this way we help Athaclena,"
Uther Calding said.
"By thumbing our noses at the enemy, by smiling as if we have thought of something special which they have not, by frightening creatures who deserve what they get for having no sense of humor."
Robert made no outward gesture to show that he understood, but to Uther Calding's delight, he recognized the glyph the young man formed, a simple version of Kinney Woolen. He laughed. Obviously it was one Robert had learned and earned from Athaclena.
"Yes, my strange adopted son, we must keep the Gubru painfully aware that boys will do what boys do."
It was later, though, toward sunset, that Uther Calding stood up suddenly in his dark tent and walked outside. He stared again to the east, tendrils waving, seeking. Somewhere out there he knew his daughter was thinking furiously. Something, some news perhaps, had come to her, and now she was concentrating as if her life depended on it. Then the brief, fey moment of linkage passed. Uther Calding turned, but he did not go back to his own shelter. Instead, he wandered a little north and pulled aside the flap of Robert's tent. The human looked up from his reading, the light of the data well casting a wild expression onto his face.
"I believe there actually is one way by which we could get off this mountain," he told the human. "At least for a little while."
"Go on," Robert said. Uther Calding smiled.
"Did I not once say to you, or was it your mother, that all things begin and end at the library?"